So we have been looking at the book of Daniel. We are now in the last chapter, and we have the intention to bring it to conclusion. There's still a fair amount here, so we'll see if we can work our way through the passage and the text. But just a little bit of review, and that starts with recognizing that the visions of Daniel provide a glimpse into the near and the far future. There are several places in Daniel that included some visions, and these deal with other nations of the world initially, but eventually it's going to have more of an impact or a focus on the impact on the nation Israel. How are the things that are going to be happening in those nations going to impact the Lord's people, Israel? The first visions give an overview, and then the details are gradually filled in more and more as the focus moves more future. And we have seen that as we have been looking at the book of Daniel. The first visions relate to things prior to Christ's first coming, and the later visions relate to details prior to Christ's second coming. So it's important to see that connection and to recognize that there is a specificity to the way in which these things have been communicated and the timing as it relates to things prior to Christ's first coming, prior to Christ's second coming. So since the details relating to Christ's first coming were fulfilled precisely and literally, we expect that the later prophecies relating to his second coming will likewise be fulfilled literally and precisely. That is a very important principle to recognize. The final vision ends with a focus on the effects of future world events on the Lord's people, Israel. And this will be our focus today in the final chapter of Daniel. Whereas the previous verses have focused on the Antichrist, as we had just looked at recently, these final verses of Daniel's final vision are going to concern Israel particularly. And so here we learn that at this end time, it will be a time of intense persecution for the Jews. That's something that's pointed out. That will be a theme that will be recognized in other passages of the Old Testament and the New Testament as well. This section also constitutes the climax of this revelation of chapters 10 through 12, as well as the climax of the whole series of prophecies in this book. In other words, it's the culmination. It's sort of kind of wrapping things up tight, as one would expect in a book of this nature. So what we want to recognize is that it highlights God's faithfulness to his promises to his chosen people, Israel. And so we will see how things culminate then for Israel and for Daniel, because he's going to be sort of focused on in this last section as well. So we want to start by recognizing the culmination of conflict and deliverance for Israel. Looking at verse 1, we read, "At that time Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even at that time. And at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book." So several interesting things to want to delve into and consider here. There's a time of great trouble that is coming for Israel. That's what's largely communicated here. There is a designated defender for Israel. This is pointed out as being Michael, the archangel, and he will rise in defense of this nation that's focused on what's going to be coming in the end time. He's also referenced previously. He is the prominent angel responsible to protect Israel. So that's interesting that there's an angel who is specifically designated to be the protector of Israel, specifically in the future. He's also mentioned in Daniel 10:13, referenced as chief prince, and verse 21 as your prince. So that's kind of personalizing as well. So this revelation focuses our attention again on the invisible and the supernatural dimension of the events that will take place. And so we're reminded that there is always more than what meets the eye. And I think it's helpful to recognize that as we consider the book of Daniel and you see the things that are going on behind the scenes and recognize that God is at work, even if it isn't immediately obvious to us on the exterior, we can recognize that that is likely the case. There is a clear warning of great trouble coming as well. The phrase, now at that time, introduces additional information about this end time. It does not introduce a chronologically subsequent event. This period generally will be a time of extreme distress for the Jews, and it will be worse than any other time in their national history. And there have been many difficult times in their history. Various other texts have a similar indication, like Deuteronomy 4:30, Jeremiah 37, Matthew 24:21, and then, of course, Revelation 6 through 19 is really dealing with the specifics of that. Now, there are some who argue that the day of the Lord, the time of Jacob's trouble, and the great tribulation are all terms that are used to describe the 3.5-year period at the latter end of the tribulation period. And it's a time of intense trouble that is associated with the last half of Daniel's 70th week, which was pointed out in Daniel 9:27. This is mostly accurate. That is, that these different terms are relating to the same time, day of the Lord, time of Jacob's trouble, the great tribulation. But the day of the Lord is broader than that. It's not just that period, because the day of the Lord can refer to that period, but it can also refer to the whole 7-year period of the tribulation, to the millennium, to both periods together, and at other times that God breaks into history dramatically. So when you see the designation, the day of the Lord, you need to see it as bigger than just that period of time. And as we will be looking at the book of Zechariah, we'll see that that is a theme that's communicated there as well. The repetition of the phrase, your people, in this verse also clearly identifies that we're talking about the Jews here in particular, not necessarily all believers. So it is very specific in its focus. Daniel's people are the Jews. That's who is in focus here, and they will be the object of intense persecution, though there will be others who will be part of that who are not necessarily Jews who will suffer during this time frame as well. And so Israel's land will become basically an international battlefield in the future, and Matthew 24:22 reminds us of that. So this is obviously a matter of concern for Daniel because he is concerned about his people. He's concerned about how the Lord is going to work with them. What are the implications for what the future holds? How the Messiah is going to be a part of Israel's future as well. Then there's the reference to the book that could use some clarification. There is a promised provision of rescue for all those Jews whose names are written in the book. A book is referred to in chapter 7, 18, and verse 27 as well. We want to recognize that this is not a promise of spiritual regeneration. That comes only by faith in God's provision through Christ, through the Messiah, for the Jews living then, as now, as for us, as well as for the future. But rather, this is a promise of national deliverance from human enemies. That's the context. That's what we're dealing with here. It's referenced in Zechariah 12:10 and 13:8-9, as well as Romans 11:26. And the book that's referred to here probably contains the names of all the Jews living in that region then who will experience physical deliverance. And Revelation 12, 13 to 17, talking about the persecution of the beast, probably has a parallel here. So the figure of a book tends to indicate a divine record that is generally written, recorded somehow in advance, and is a basis for this rescue. There are several books that God keeps, and it's referred to in Revelation 20:12, as well as Exodus 32:33, Psalm 69:28, Malachi 3:16, Luke 10:20. Verse 20, Revelation 20:15, and others. Just a reminder that when we see a reference to names written in the book, you want to look at the context, see who it's relating to, because they may be different purposes, different functions, different persons. There may be physical implications, there may be spiritual implications, and this is a subject I think is worthy of an additional study. I hope sometime to put together a study on that particular topic. Then, continuing on, and this thing is being silly. It's a little jumpy. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So this is a time of resurrection for his people, and this is a time that is coming for God's people. So we have a question to consider here. What is the nature of this resurrection? What exactly is in view? So to start with, we may have a question, well, why did the angel say many will awake and not all? Is there not a resurrection of everybody involved, or is there a particular context that is in view here? So apparently he did so to stress the fact that those Jews who die because of Antichrist persecution will experience the resurrection at the end of this period. So it's a particular time. It's at the time of at the end of the tribulation. And that coincides with Revelation 20, verses 4 to 6. He referred to the hope of those Jews in particular. That's those who were living at that time. And so that's why it's a reference to many, because we're talking about a specific resurrection, because there are many different times and individuals involved in various resurrections that Scripture refers to. So this wording clarifies that not all will arise then at that particular time. Some will experience resurrection at other times in history, like 1 Thessalonians 4, 13 to 17 talks about those who will be raised up prior to or at the time of the rapture. The angel meant a physical resurrection here rather than just a renewal of the soul, because some have tried to sort of spiritualize it, but there seems to be the physical resurrection is in view because of reference to the dust of the ground. He used terminology that would kind of clarify things, and that's sort of figurative for the grave. They'd be raised from the grave, from the dead. The Old Testament standard way of envisioning dying and coming back to life is by speaking of lying down and sleeping and then waking and getting up. So there's an analogy there that's helpful to think about. So the image that's communicated here presupposes a restoring to life of the whole person with its spiritual and material aspects. And what we want to recognize is that the Bible doesn't talk about sleep in reference to the soul. Sleep is not an activity of the soul. Sleep is an activity of the body. So we don't recognize something that has been referred to as soul sleep, as some cults would emphasize. Some of the Jews will enter into everlasting life, namely those who are believers. Others will experience disgrace and everlasting contempt because they do not believe on Christ. So evidently those martyred during the tribulation and resurrected at this time will reign with Christ during his millennial kingdom, which will begin with his return to earth at the end of the tribulation. So another question to think about here is, what is the timing of the resurrections referenced here? Well, this verse teaches that there will be a resurrection of the wicked, but it doesn't say that it will occur at the end of the tribulation. It only says that others will awake to disgrace and everlasting contempt. The text of Revelation 20 makes clear that the resurrection of the wicked will occur at the end of the millennium, not at the end of the tribulation. In the context of Daniel 12:2, the emphasis is on the hope of the Jews who will die in the tribulation. That's the focus of this time frame and the details that are given regarding this resurrection. The destiny of the wicked is brought up simply to clarify that they too will be raised, but not to specify just when. And also we want to recognize that this is the first mention in the Old Testament of a twofold resurrection. And for this reason, we see it as a very important verse to recognize. And of course, in John chapter 5, Jesus refers to a resurrection of both unbelievers and believers as well. Also, this verse identifies the time of the physical resurrection of saved Jews, that is, those who live outside of the church age. So those who argue simply on the basis of the concept of lifetime or age for only an age-long punishment in hell rather than on endless duration need to reckon with the many passages in the Old Testament where the word everlasting or olam is used with referring to God as having endless life or his sovereignty. So if it's a word that's used for God and he has eternality, when it's used in the context of resurrection, then that also is not limited, but goes on for eternity as well. So, in other words, if hell is not eternal, then neither is God, because the same Hebrew and Greek words are used for both in the Bible. So that's, again, just an important point of clarification to make. Then another question here is, what is the significance of this resurrection reference here? Why is it included here? What is it trying to say? Well, there's a continuing emphasis on hope for the Jews living during this time. Part of what is communicated, because Daniel is concerned about what's going to happen to his people in the future, because he has seen things that are going to happen to the nation prior to Christ's first coming, and he has concerns relative to Christ's second coming as well. So this text indicates that rewards will follow resurrection. Those Jews who have insight into the importance of remaining faithful to God and who do so will receive glory. That's kind of what's communicated here. Those who lead others to do right will also. Their glory will be similar to the glory of the sky above and to the stars. That's kind of the picture, the imagery that's given as far as an analogy. So the angel expressed this blessing in this sort of beautiful parallelism to give a picture of what their future expectation can be. And their glory will involve the privilege of reigning with Jesus Christ during his millennial kingdom and from then on. And there are other passages that indicate this, like Matthew 25:14-30, Luke 19:11-27, Revelation 24, just to, as a reminder that there are other passages that clarify and validate this. So these two verses, verses 2 and 3, affirm the doctrines of resurrection and eternity beyond the grave. That's one of the things that we want to recognize. And even the most skeptical Old Testament scholars will concede the presence of these doctrines here. They see that's what it's saying. Even if they don't accept it, they see that's what it's saying. And that's at least an important element to recognize. There are other Old Testament verses that teach these doctrines, like Job 19:26, Psalm 16:11, 17:15, 73:23-24, Isaiah 25:8, Isaiah 26:19. This emphasis is not just in Daniel alone. So we can be encouraged by this early reference to the hope of the resurrection. I mean, it's something that we look to. We see Christ's resurrection as the precursor to the other resurrections that follow. And the New Testament is clear in pointing out that the resurrection is a critical doctrine that we need to recognize. Then looking at verse 4, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase." Now, have you ever read that passage and wondered, what exactly do you mean by that? Well, we want to give that some thought as well. So we have final instructions to Daniel regarding the vision. There are still some visionary elements in this last section, but the main content of Revelation has been communicated, but then there's some sort of epilogue element that's communicated in these last few verses of the book and of this chapter. So, what is he to do with the words of the vision? That's a question we want to think about. Well, the angel concluded his revelation to Daniel with instruction to close the record of this revelation. Now, what we want to recognize is the terminology that's used here has some significance from that time frame. In ancient Near East times, people would write official documents, and then after making a copy for reference, they would deposit the original in a safe place. That sounds like a good idea. I think we do that with various things as well, so it's not something totally new. Some of us have learned to keep hard copies of things that we put on our computer because who knows what might happen to that crazy thing. It sometimes can give us grief. And we wonder, what happened to my information? Where did it go? Well, they had similar concerns. But they just didn't have the same kind of technological equipment as we have to deal with. And maybe sometimes they were better off. So then the phrase, conceal these words, we want to think of, okay, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that Daniel should keep them to himself, but that he should preserve this revelation because it was important. It was also customary for the scribe, the one who recorded such things, this kind of important document, such as contractual promises, that sort of thing. He would run a cylinder seal across the bottom to guarantee its authenticity. In other words, he would put a marked seal on it, and that would show that it was legitimate. And this is what the angel instructed Daniel to do with this particular promise that came from the Lord. So by sealing it, Daniel would essentially certify that what was written there was exactly what God revealed to him, and that is what he promised would happen, and that he could trust it. Kind of reminds us of Revelation 22, 18 to 19, with the emphasis there that don't take away from, don't add to. So Daniel was to preserve this revelation, that is, the book of Daniel in particular, until the time of the end, That is, thinking about the last half of the tribulation, because much of what God had revealed to him concerned the far distant future. So it needed to be preserved beyond the present because it related to things much beyond the present for Daniel. And then he confessed that he did not understand much of it. Verse 8, and we can certainly understand the concern there because there are things in it that we look at and wonder. If it's something that hasn't taken place yet, it's not real clear sometimes exactly how it is going to take place because it hasn't happened yet. And it hadn't for Daniel, and it hasn't in many ways for the things that are indicated for the distant future have not yet occurred as well. Oh, it jumped ahead again. Pat can put it back. There we go. Okay, now another question is, what is the significance of the increase of knowledge? We live in a time where there is a great increase in knowledge, although sometimes one wonders if it qualifies as knowledge, if it isn't necessarily true, because there's a lot of that's going on out there. So the last part of this verse probably refers to the attempts of people in the future to understand this revelation in view of the context. In their attempt to understand these prophecies, people would search around and try to discover what they meant. And that kind of has the idea of running to and fro. They're going to be seeking to understand this as best they can, but over time, with addition of history and other validations of things, there may be more knowledge because it's accumulating over time. There might be an increased understanding as time passes, and that there will be those who come after Daniel, who may understand it better than what Daniel did because he didn't have the completed revelation as we do. And so I would assume that that's likely what is involved here. So the implication is that attempts to understand the truth will require considerable effort, whether or not one has to physically run to and fro to find those things, but there's a lot of moving around in the world over time that takes place. And even though Daniel and his people did not understand the prophecies as well as we do, the predictions did comfort them because it gave an idea of how things were going to transpire in the future. But we have the benefit of seeing many of the things that were predicted fulfilled in the past, because they're past to us. They were still, even the earlier things were still future to Daniel, but they're past to us. So we have an accumulation of knowledge that Daniel did not have, just because we've seen the history that had been previously predicted fulfilled, and we anticipate, as we have pointed out, that those things that have yet to take place future to us will be fulfilled as they had been prior to Christ's first coming. So this would have been a reassuring thing that for the people, that the Lord God, Yahweh, would deliver his people from the hostile Gentiles and would then fulfill his covenant promises to his people. And so they could take heart and be encouraged by that. Oh, it jumped ahead again. The indication of the end of Israel's trials, as we look at the last several verses here. Looking at verses 5 through 7, then I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two others, one on this riverbank and the other on that riverbank. And one said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters on the river, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? Daniel's thinking practically, how long? When is this going to take place? Then I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. What are we talking about here? An expression of concern for the timing of the end. So there's the first question was from one angel to another. Daniel continued to view things in the vision that he began describing back in chapter 10, verse 5. And so now the book is going to end with a brief question and answer session. The first question is in verses 5 and 6. So Daniel now saw two other individuals that were undoubtedly angels based on the context and the description that's given. And this was besides the angel who had been addressing him since chapter 10, verse 11. And these angels were standing on either side of the Tigris River as he was seeing this communicated to him. One of these angels asked a question of the man dressed in linen. Some suspect maybe that was the Son of Man, Messiah, the angel of the Lord, though it's not definitive, who was above the river. And he wanted to know how long it would be until the end of the events that were just related, namely the events that have to do with Israel's final persecution and deliverance. And if they're going to be thinking about having to deal with persecution, hearing about deliverance certainly would have been some element of encouragement. Well, then the first answer is given in verse 7. The man above the river swore by the eternal God that he was about, that what he was about to say is true. You could trust it, be confident in it. Normally, people who would swear by God would lift one hand to heaven. This one is lifting both hands to heaven. It's been suggested that this is stressing the truthfulness of what is about to be revealed. So even greater confidence. So this was assurance that the Lord was ready to again deliver his people. The meaning of time, times, and half a time is understood as 3.5 years. That terminology has been used before. It will be used again, not only in Daniel, but in the New Testament, particularly the book of Revelation. The reference to shattering the power of the holy people refers to the terrible persecution that the Jews are going to be dealing with in the end. And that is largely to get them to come to the end of themselves so that they will look to the Lord, to their Messiah that they have rejected previously. So there was ultimately some good news in this, in that there was a time frame. It was going to be limited. It was not going to go on and on and on. And it was for a time, times, and half a time. So the intense persecution that the Jews would have to face would be focused on the last half of that period. And this was an indication of some limitation of suffering, and so that would have provided some element of hope that there would be, even though there's persecution coming, it is limited. Then verses 8 to 10. Although I heard, I did not understand. Then I said, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified, made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Then continuing, verses 11 to 13. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. But you go your way till the end, for you shall rest and will arise to your inheritance at the end of the days. So again, lots of things to think about here. We see an expression of concern for the nature of the end. The second question, that is, oh, it jumped ahead again. The second question was from Daniel to an angel. Daniel continued having difficulty comprehending this revelation. He acknowledges that I heard it, but I don't know that I understand it. And then there are those of us who may read it today, and we say, I read it, but I'm not sure I understand it. There's still some elements like, this is not as clear as I'd like it to be. So we want to see if we can come up with a little bit of more understanding on this. So it prompted him to respectfully ask the angelic messenger how everything would end. How is this going to come together? And he may have been particularly interested in having a better understanding about the nature of this resurrection emphasis that was pointed out, the rewards that are associated with that, that was pointed out earlier in verses 1 through 3. The second answer provided some instruction and encouragement, verses 9 and 10. So here the Lord reminded Daniel that much of what he had received would remain obscure until the end time. He's not going to understand it all because it's beyond him in terms of time, and probably some of the circumstances would have been difficult to communicate. We know that when the Apostle John was trying to communicate what he saw in his vision on Patmos in the book of Revelation, he was struggling with coming up with words that would be adequate to communicate what he saw in terms of language and technology that was available to him at the time. So it's helpful for us to think about that as well. Then people will be able to look back. They will marvel at the total fulfillment of prophecy. They will glorify the sovereign Most High God. God in his infinite wisdom has revealed to us only that which is needful for us to have in order that we may know what he requires of us. In other words, he's not going to give us everything all at once. He will give us what we need, and he'll give us what we can handle. If he told us everything there was to know, they might not know what to deal with it. And I am reminded of occasions when there are things that come our way that if we knew all what was going to be involved with a particular thing that we have to deal with, we might rethink going down that path. But it's a path we need to go down. So we certainly can appreciate that. And he does not reveal that which does not directly contribute toward this end. And so he will reveal what is necessary and appropriate. Scripture is not given simply to be some sort of mystery to satisfy our idle curiosity. He gives us that which is necessary and appropriate. So all the troubles that are coming upon the earth, especially upon the Jews, are not without purpose. All of the suffering, the persecutions, the things that would be viewed as unpleasant, undesirable, those things that we would not want to have to go through, that we may have to deal with in our own experience at times. Many throughout history have already had to deal with some of those kinds of things, and the Jews are going to have to deal with those kinds of things as well. It is not without purpose. Often it is to bring us to the place where we need to be in terms of our heart response to the Lord. And that's part of what is referenced here. It's talking about spiritual purification that is going to be taking place, and that probably often, we need to go through hard times to get us to see things the way we ought to see them. We tend not to do all that well when things are going just wonderfully for us. We tend to grow when we're going through difficult experiences. But it also says that the wicked will continue to act wickedly, and they will not understand what is happening. But those who know the Lord, who are wise to what he has communicated in his word, they will understand. They will pay attention to the divine revelation that is given here. So in the Old Testament and in Scripture generally, a wise person is one who lives in light of the divine revelation that he has received, and the fool is one who ignores it. The book of Proverbs makes that quite evident. So this verse then gives us some motivation to pay attention to what God has revealed and to encourage us to study it carefully. And there is certainly value in that of having an understanding of what is coming. And so it should help us to avoid thinking, probably naively, that the passing of time and the fulfillment of prophecy will cause bad people to change their ways. We would like to think that that is the case. There will still be evil right up to the end, and not everyone will be responsive, even if they have lots and lots of revealed truth, biblical revelation, and even experiences of difficulty. Not all will accept it, and things contrary to what some of the post-millennialists and even some amillennialists would assume, that things are getting better and better. If we've looked at history past and we can project what we see toward the future, we see that is not likely the case. Even the social evolutionists of the world around us think, well, things are just going to get better and better. And all we have to do is just educate people. My observation is the places of education probably are some of the worst places out there, so beware. So the second answer provided some instruction and some encouragement. The second answer also provided more information and even provoked more curiosity. Don't you love that? When you want to know something more, and then somebody gives you something more, and then it raises more questions than gives answers, and that's kind of the case here. So the divine messenger conceded to Daniel's request and provided some more information. However, as things were unclear to Daniel, many of those things are still somewhat unclear for interpreters today, even us, when we look at some of these things. So the Lord measured the time between the end, presumably the end of the tribulation, and the time that the Antichrist will terminate Jewish sacrifices and desecrate the temple. And it will be 1,290 days. And this will be 30 days longer than the 3.5 years previously mentioned. And so there's an extra month. Where do we put that? How do we deal with that? So it's assumed that this must be either 30 days before the 3.5 years or after it or somehow both. How do we put those together? Well, there are various views regarding the meaning of this. Perhaps the Antichrist will terminate the sacrifices and desecrate the temple 30 days before the middle of the 70th week. So there's kind of a preparatory period of time that's considered there. That interpretation views the explanation of this verse as more specific, and the one in Daniel 9:27 as a general description. A similar view is that the Antichrist may announce the termination of sacrifices and the setting up of the abomination 30 days before he carries out those acts. It's another possibility. Another option is that there will be a 30-day period between the time when the Antichrist abolishes the regular sacrifice and the time when he sets up the abomination of desolation. Could be that's where that figures in. Or, I should wait a moment, let those settle in just a little bit before I add another one. A fourth possibility is that the 30 days will extend beyond the last 3.5 years, and it will include the cleansing of the temple and possibly the judgments of Israel and the nations that Christ will execute when he returns. Again, looking at some additional passages like Ezekiel 34 to 38, or Matthew 25:31 to 46. So there are various possibilities. Like I said, it may bring up more questions than answers as we think about that. So the Lord said that those will be blessed who keep waiting, presumably for God's rescue of them, and attain to the 1,335 days. So why did he mention this particular number of days, and when will this period end? Well, this time frame of 1,335 days is 45 days longer than the 1,290-day period that were just mentioned. So it's an additional month and a half. So evidently this period will end after the tribulation has ended, namely after the millennial reign of Christ has begun, or at least after he has returned to earth. So we can only really speculate about what these 45 days following the tribulation will hold for the people that are living on the earth at that time. Some think that this 45-day period is for Christ to accomplish the necessary judgments and to set up the kingdom after returning to the earth. Some have suggested, I'm throwing out more options that are going to overwhelm us probably, but some favor the view that these 30 and before, 45 day after, if that's the way, could be a matter of using different calendars than the ones that were used for the 1,260 days. I don't necessarily have a basis for that, but calendars do change. Julius Caesar sought to provide some correction there. There's the Julian calendar, the Gregorian calendar, Jewish calendar, the Chinese calendar. So there's other calendars out there. How do you know what to go by? So some have speculated that that might be the case. But whatever the explanation, the verse encourages believers that are living during this tribulation time to remain faithful to the Lord, to be wise in following Scripture and obeying Him, and it's likely an encouragement for us as well. So then the Lord, in the last verse, sort of dismisses the prophet, and says, okay, you can take the rest of the day off. You've had a hard time here with all of these visions that you've had to deal with, and this last one, you know, was loaded with stuff. So he's now permitted to go his way to the end. And by the end, we assume that it may have meant the end of his life, because that was not far off. He was well up in years by this time, well into his 80s at least, we think. And so it seems like that may be the emphasis of what is intended here. And he will then conclude his life and receive his reward, his inheritance, his allotted portion from the Lord. So there could be an end of in view here, an end for the nation of the Lord's return, the establishment of the kingdom. That end is part of the ultimate picture, but also an end for Daniel himself individually is part of the end that's communicated in this passage. So there's an anticipation for Daniel of being resurrected, and anticipation for his people. And then from the New Testament, we know that other believers are part of the equation as well. So let me bring some concluding thoughts to bear here. This book closes with a reminder that the present age of Gentile domination is not all that God has in store for humankind. That is part of the picture, but that's not all that there is. There's another age coming beyond the present one in which Jesus Christ will reign in righteousness and holiness on the earth. Isaiah 11:9 references that, Zechariah 9:10 as well. And Christians should look forward to the beginning of this messianic age and pray for its coming. Matthew 6:10, Luke 11:2 also has that emphasis. So this book was intended to be some encouragement for the Jews of Daniel's day, and it was to be an encouragement for God's people as history continued to unfold as well. So today we can see it more clearly because we have an accumulation of the totality of Scripture, and we also have history having been played out to this point. We may not know exactly when some of these things are going to take place, but we can see them moving more clearly in that direction, and it should give us confidence in what the Lord has communicated to us, that we can trust Him, we can trust His promises to His people, Israel, to us as believers, and we need to take that to heart. I guess I forgot to push the button on those. So what other practical effects should an understanding of Daniel's prophecies have on us today? I push the button and nothing happens, or I push the button and everything happens. Go figure. We can understand how God will create history, and we can know something of the times and seasons that are still future. So we can see that God is at work. Those things that had been predicted have come to pass. Those other things that have been predicted that have not yet come to pass, we expect will come to pass in a similar fashion. This knowledge should help us feel the urgency of our present commission. Our commission is to make disciples of all nations. That should stand clearly in our thinking. Our time is getting less in which to accomplish the objective that we've been given. So it should spur us on to evangelism and to discipleship. That's what we've been called to do for those believers who are in this present age. It should give us a sense of peace as we go through the trouble that we find in this world and hope that God will win the battle over evil. Hope in the sense of confident expectation, because we know from His Word that that is the case. It should encourage us to inform God's people of what He has revealed so that they can be informed and ready for what is coming. And it should cause us to live holy lives in view of the Lord's return. That was the emphasis in, I believe it was 2 Peter chapter 3. In light of all these things that are coming upon us, how ought we to live in light of that reality? That's what we're reminded of here. We don't know what it is that we may have to endure before the Lord's return. We have an idea of what Israel is going to have to endure, but we don't know what exactly for us. There are many believers in the world at present who are suffering greatly. We may have to deal with some of that as well. But we do have confidence knowing how it will ultimately end. And we can trust Him and we can serve Him in the time that we have, whatever time it is, and take heart in that. And we may want to be reminded of the question, are we ready for His soon return?